Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the 2020 Chemical Data Reporting Requirements Conference Call. At this time, all participants are on a listen-only mode. After the speaker's presentation, there will be a question-and-answer session. To ask a question during the session, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone. Please be advised that today's conference is being recorded. If you require any further assistance, please press star 0. I would now like to hand the conference over to your speaker today, Meredith Combs. Thank you. Please go ahead.
All right, thank you. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for calling in today. We really appreciate your patience and willingness to participate in this webinar. My name is Meredith Combs. I'm in the Office of Pollution Prevention and Toxics here at EPA. I'll be presenting today along with my colleague Tom Smith and Carolina Falele, who is a contractor with the organization CGI Federal. Today, we are providing an overview of the 2020 chemical data reporting collection period, which will begin this year on June 1st, 2020. The way that this webinar will function is that we ask that you follow along with the PDF version of the slides that we have provided you in the confirmation email. In that email, there should be a link that links to the EPA website. There are two documents there, one called CDR Regulatory Overview, which will be part one of this webinar, and the second document is the CDR Reporting Tool Walkthrough, which is part two. Before moving on to each slide, I will indicate what number I'm on. So right now, I'm in the first of those two documents. I'm on the title slide of the first document called CDR Regulatory Overview. And I would just like to note that after this title slide, all of the slide numbers will be in the lower right-hand corner. I'm now transitioning to slide one. Here's an overview of our presentation. Today's presentation will last about 2 hours and have two parts. The first part will be background on the Toxic Substances Control Act, the Chemical Data Reporting Program, and an overview of the reporting requirements. Second, we will go through a walkthrough with screenshots of the reporting tool that will be the second document that you have downloaded. If time allows, we will allow for a question and answer section. I'm now on slide two. I will quickly provide some history on the Toxic Substances Control Act, which is abbreviated as TSCA. TSCA is the premier chemical safety legislation in the U.S. This gives EPA the authority to require reporting, record-keeping, and testing requirements and restrictions related to chemical substances and or mixtures. TSCA was initially passed in 1976 and most recently updated in 2016 with the Frank R. Lautenberg Chemical Safety for the 21st Century Act, also called the Lautenberg Act. For the Chemical Data Reporting Program, we're focused on substances that are listed on the TSCA inventory. The TSCA inventory is a comprehensive listing of chemicals in commerce in the U.S. This was created in the late 1970s and currently lists about 85,000 chemical substances, with 42,000 of those identified as active in commerce. I'm now transitioning to slide three, and we'll provide a quick overview of the Chemical Data Reporting Program, which we abbreviate as CDR. CDR is really a first look or high-level view of chemicals in commerce in the U.S., and it is essential for the work that we do here at EPA. CDR is a collection of basic exposure-related information on the types, quantities, and uses of chemical substances manufactured domestically or imported into the United States. This applies only to chemical substances listed on the TSCA inventory, and certain classes of chemicals are exempted from reporting. This information is submitted every 4 years, and the last submission period ended in 2016. It's 4 years later. We're in 2020, so the current submission period will begin on June 1st, 2020, and will cover the calendar years of 2016 through 2019. Many of you are familiar with the CDR revisions rule, which was finalized this month in March of 2020. The finalization of this rule will affect the CDR reporting requirements. We will go into more detail on that in a moment. It is also important to note that at the end of the submission period was extended from September 30th to November 30th of this year to provide additional time for reporters to become familiar with these requirements. We are also in the process of finalizing a small manufacturer definition, which has been proposed but not yet final. I am now on slide four. Here I will go into more detail on what was included in the final CDR revisions rule, which will affect this reporting period. There were three main goals for this revisions rule. First, to update CDR to align with the new statutory requirements for TSCA. This is to coincide with the Lautenberg Act in 2016. CDR is essential for the implementation of TSCA here at the agency, and we are constantly reevaluating our data needs. So the second goal was to improve CDR data to support the implementation of TSCA. Third, we had the goal of reducing burden for certain CDR reporters. In order to meet these goals, the summary of the changes we made were first, exemptions for reporting of certain byproducts, changes to claiming confidentiality to align with the Lautenberg Act, modifications to reportable data elements, changes to simplify reporting processes for co-manufactured chemicals. This rule was proposed in April 2019 and, as mentioned, was finalized in March of this year. I would also like to note that in this presentation, green text indicates new reporting requirements or an updated reporting requirement. So as we go through this presentation, anything that is in green indicates that it is different from the last reporting period. So you can keep track of that as we go through this today. And then also, if you reference these slides at a later date, you can recall that anything green is new. I am now transitioning to slide 5. This is just a title slide indicating that we are transitioning to the portion of the presentation where we will be talking about the 2020 reporting requirements for CDR. I am now on slide 6, which is an overview of the CDR reporting requirements. First off, the submission period will be from June 1st to November 30th of 2020. Again, that is an extension of the initial deadline of the reporting period. The CDR applies to all manufacturers, which under TSCA includes importers of chemical substances that are listed on the TSCA inventory as of June 1st, 2020, have a production volume of 25,000 pounds or greater at a site in at least one of the years from 2016 through 2019, unless they are subject to certain TSCA actions in which the production volume is 2,500 pounds or greater. You are also required to report if you are not eligible for a full or partial exemption from the CDR. I'm now on slide 7. For each chemical that is reported, certain information is required, and you must provide the following information: the annual production volume from 2016 through 2019, certain manufacturing information for 2019, processing and use information for 2019, and certain exemptions may reduce reporting, which will be explained later in this presentation. All submissions are sent to EPA electronically through EPA's Central Data Exchange, which is also called CDX, in which a participant must register with CDX, access the eCDR web, which is the CDR reporting tool, create and submit a separate Form U for each site, and submit the completed Form U following the instructions that are available on eCDR web. I am now on slide 8. We will now move through an exercise to determine your need to report. You must consider each chemical substance that you domestically manufactured or imported at a single site from 2016 through 2019. First, you must consider if your chemical substance is subject to CDR, and second, are you a manufacturer that is required to report? I am now transitioning to slide 9. Here are some things to consider when you are evaluating if your chemical is subject to the CDR. First, is your chemical substance listed on the TSCA inventory? Next, is your chemical substance manufactured for commercial purposes, which means to import, produce, or manufacture with the purpose of obtaining an immediate eventual commercial advantage to the manufacturer? Next, is your chemical substance used only for non-TSCA uses as defined by TSCA Section 32B? Additionally, you should consider, is your chemical substance partially exempt from reporting? And also, is your chemical substance ineligible for exemption? I'm now moving on to slide 10. Here is an overview of chemical-specific exemptions, which are outlined in the CFR at 40 CFR 711.6. Some chemicals are fully exempt from reporting, which includes polymers, microorganisms, and certain forms of natural gas and water, as well as naturally occurring chemical substances. Some chemicals are partially exempt from processing and use reporting. This includes listed petroleum processing streams and chemicals whose processing and use information is of low current interest. Some chemicals are not eligible for exemptions if they're subject to certain TSCA actions. So we're going to actually transition from slide 10 to slide 11. Here on slide 11, we have a chart. This is a list of TSCA actions that would make your chemical ineligible for an exemption. And it is slightly difficult to see, but in the middle of the chart, section 4 orders, that is a green check mark, the green indicating that it is a new requirement. So this is new for this reporting period. I'm now on slide 12. We are going to look at a chemical-specific example and determine if this chemical is subject to being reported to CDR. This is a screenshot from EPA's Substance Registry Service, the link of which is at the bottom of this slide. Tom is going to go into a bit more detail about how to use SRS in a moment, but I'd just like to note that this is a search for a generic chemical. This CAS number is 123456. And this is an output of the regulations it is subject to. So we have here in this screenshot a list of the regulations that this chemical is subject to. So here on slide 13, I'm now on slide 13, we have a red circle around the 2016 CDR TSCA inventory. Here we can see that this chemical is subject to the 2016 TSCA inventory and therefore is subject to the CDR. Here on slide 14, I've transitioned to slide 14, we would like to note that this example still references 2016, which is the last reporting period, but the time reporting for this cycle begins on June 1st of this year. We will have updated information for 2020, which includes two lists, which indicate if the chemical is active or inactive on the TSCA inventory. I'm now moving on to slide 15. We will now evaluate if the production volume threshold for your chemical meets the requirement to report to CDR. Remember that the production volume threshold for chemicals is at 25,000 pounds, or for certain TSCA actions, it is lower at 2,500 pounds. You must consider the production volume for each of the calendar years of the reporting period. So for this year in 2020, that means for the years 2016, 2017, 2018, and 2019. I am now moving on to slide 16. Let's evaluate the production volume of a sample company. Here we have a sample company called Chem Inc. A. Chem Inc. A manufactures three chemicals, chemical A, chemical B, and chemical C. For this example, let's assume that these chemicals are not subject to any certain TSCA actions and the lower reporting threshold. So here, looking first at chemical A, in 2016, 2017, and 2018, the production volume was under 25,000 pounds, but in 2019, it exceeded 25,000 pounds. This makes the company required to report on that chemical. For chemical B, we see that in 2016, 2018, and 2019, they did not produce this chemical at all. However, in 2017, they made this chemical and it exceeded the 25,000 pound threshold. Therefore, they must report on this chemical. For chemical C, we can see that for all 4 years, they did not meet the reporting threshold and therefore are not required to report on this chemical. I'm now on slide 17. In general, the reporting threshold remains at 25,000 pounds. However, a reduced reporting threshold at 2,500 pounds applies to chemical substances subject to certain TSCA actions. We're going to transition to the chart on slide 18. I am now on slide 18. This table here lists TSCA actions that may affect the reporting threshold. So you can see for the first three here, it does not affect the reporting threshold, so it remains at 25,000 pounds. And then the remainder of this chart are all actions that would trigger the lower reporting threshold for certain chemicals. So you can see, and I would just like to note again that the Section 4 orders, that is a green check mark, so that indicates that that is a new requirement. I'm now transitioning to slide 19. Again, here is an export of the regulations that this generic CAS number is subject to. We have a list of these regulations that impact this chemical. And I just like to take a moment and see if there's anything that might trigger the that would trigger the lower threshold for this substance. So if we transition to slide 20, we have a red circle around the TSCA Section 6 unreasonable risk, which would trigger the lower reporting threshold. I'm now transitioning to slide 21. Here we are going to check in again with our company, Chem Inc. A. We've already talked about chemicals A through C that they manufacture. They also manufacture three more chemicals, chemicals D, E, and F. For chemical D, we see they are subject to a TSCA Section 6 rule, which triggers the lower reporting threshold. And in 2016, they manufactured 3,000 pounds, which exceeds the lower reporting threshold, and so they are required to report on this chemical. For chemical E is subject to one of the previously listed TSCA actions, but they are not required to report because they did not meet or exceed the 2,500-pound reporting threshold in any of the four reporting years. For chemical F, we see that chemical F is also subject to the TSCA Section 5 SNR, and we see that in 2018 and 2019, they exceeded the 2,500-pound reporting threshold. I'm now transitioning to slide 22. We've covered determining the need to report based on your chemical, and we're now going to cover whether or not you are exempt as a small manufacturer and if you qualify for any other reporting exemptions. I'm now moving on to slide 23. As I've mentioned before, the small manufacturing definition has been proposed, but it has not yet been finalized. EPA has proposed this based on the update of the current two standard definition on inflation by adjusting the sales standard level. So this means basically that we would raise the current size standard total annual sales based on the $4 million and $11 million and the production volume modified standard equivalently to the $40 million and $110 million with no change to the modifier of 100,000 pounds. Just to clarify, the total annual sales are of a submitter combined with the parent company, whether the parent company is foreign or domestic. We also propose to change the inflation index to determine future changes to the revenue level and to add a definition for small government, which would be municipalities with populations less than 50,000 people. This rule is currently in interagency review. And keep in mind, it has not yet been finalized, so the definition may not ultimately be exactly how we are presenting it here today. We're going to transition now to slide 24. If you're subject, you can see this new column on the far right here. If your substance is subject to any of these listed in the last column, you are not eligible for a small manufacturer exemption. And again, just to point out the Section 4 orders here, that is a new requirement with a green check mark. I am now transitioning to slide 25, and I'm going to pass the speaking off to my colleague, Tom Smith. So Tom, please take it away.
Thanks, Meredith. Thanks for the introduction and the transition, and thanks everyone for continuing to follow along with us manually. Now I'm going to shift our focus a bit and we'll walk through finding your substance or substances and their status on SRS, which again is the Substance Registry Service. There you'll find whether your substance is on the TSCA inventory, if it is potentially partially or fully exempt from reporting, and whether or not it is subject to certain TSCA actions which may impact the reporting requirements. Updates specific to the 2020 CDR will be added to SRS prior to the upcoming reporting period. On to slide 26, we'll find what the homepage looks like. Keep in mind also that when you're using the reporting tool, it will search SRS for you. So though you can search on your own here before entering information into the reporting tool. So you'll be able to search SRS by list, single chemical or cast number or by multiple chemicals. We'll quickly go through a couple of these ways and look at a few examples, but initially we'll go by list on slide 27. You'll have a number of lists here to choose from. The few examples shown here are the 2016 or 2012 CDR eligible chemicals, as well as those that are partially or fully exempt. On or before June 1st this year, there will be 2020 CDR lists as well, but we'll start by clicking on the 2016 partially exempt list, for example, on the next slide, number 28. This list is short enough that you can filter it and browse through it in SRS. The chemicals on the partially exempt list require reporting of basic identity and manufacturing information, but not the processing and use information unless they are subject to certain TSCA actions that we laid out earlier, in which case they would require full reporting. The 2016 partially exempt list should be the same as that for 2020, as nothing has been added or changed to that on that list since then. On to slide 29, we'll see the page had we clicked on the 2016 full exempt list. These chemicals don't require reporting, but again, with the same caveat, given that they are not also subject to certain TSCA actions we listed previously. In contrast to the partial exempt list, there have been additions or changes to this list, so the 2016 full exempt list will not be exactly the same as that for 2020. We're also displaying this page as the results of some searches can be too large to display on SRS. We can, however, download the list, which we'll see on the following slide, number 30. This, for example, is the downloaded list of those chemicals that are fully exempted, again, unless otherwise excluded. So as we can see, the output list provides a good amount of information on each chemical that is included. For example, the substances identities, the common, generic, or the registry name. Also, other identifiers like the CAS number and EPA ID, as well as the effective date, or when this substance was officially added to the list. Moving on to slide 31, we'll head back to the SRS page, or the homepage. From here, we'll now start walking through searching by an individual substance. Single entry should be the default selection, but if not, we'll click on it and enter a single substance name or CAS number. On slide 32, we'll see our first example chemical. Here, you'll see that by searching the CAS number listed in the title, we pulled up the results for ethylene dibromide. When clicking on a substance, we'll see that next step on slide 33. Here, we'll see what statutes or regulations the substance may be subject to. This is an example of another substance that you can see is both on the 2016 inventory as well as the partially exempt list, meaning again that it would require reporting manufacturing information, but not the processing and use, unless subject to certain TSCA actions laid out earlier. On to slide 34, we'll see another example chemical. Hydrofluoric acid similarly is also on 2016 inventory, and as we can see, it is subject to a variety of other either action statutes or EPA programs as well. Listed are CERCLA, No-Nonsense Superfund, a few from the Clean Air Act, and one from the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, or RCRA. So now that we've gone through determining your need to report in the SRS and whether or not your chemical may be exempt, on slide 35, we'll shift our attention again, and I'll give an overview of the information to be reported, starting with what's associated with the site. And again, refer to the green text for changes since the last reporting in 2016. Previously, only the highest level U.S. parent company was reported, but now, if applicable, the highest level parent company will be reported as well. Note that there's a new definition for highest level parent company at 711.3, or 40 CFR 711.3. This definition now includes multiple scenarios, along with the manufacturing or importing site information. The new requirement of the NAICS code associated with that site will be reported. For context, NAICS is the North American Industry Classification System. Submitters will only be required to report one NAICS code, but considering multiple codes may be applicable for a single site, up to three codes, three NAICS codes will be allowed to be reported. Technical contact information is also required. This should be the person whom EPA may contact for clarification of the information in your CDR submission, someone who can answer questions about the reported substances. Typically, a person located at the manufacturing site is best able to answer such questions. And on to slide 36, after the site-associated information, you'll provide manufacturing-related data, which includes the chemical identity by name and CAS number, or by generic name and accession number, if your chemical is listed on the confidential portion of the inventory. Also reported is the production volumes for the past 4 years, 2016, 17, 18, and for 2019. Principal reporting year, much more information will be provided, including whether the volumes are imported or domestically manufactured or both, and if imported, whether the chemical was never physically at the site. Also, the volumes used on site or directly exported from the site. Additional information for 2019 specifically includes the number of workers that are reasonably likely to be exposed, which is reported in ranges, the maximum concentration, also in percent ranges, the physical form and the associated percent production volume, also the indication of whether the chemical is recycled or otherwise used instead of being treated as a waste. On top of recycling, this element used to include remanufactured, reprocessed, or reused, but we've streamlined the language more to avoid confusion and refine the information received. Lastly, there is a new voluntary data element that supporters can choose to report the percent production volume that is a byproduct. There will be a couple options: reporting this as 0 or 100% of the production volume, or using two wide ranges in between. Those are greater than 0 but less than 50%, or greater than or equal to 50% but less than 100%. Note that this isn't asking for the percent of your substance that contains a byproduct, rather the percent of the production volume that is a byproduct versus a product. As such, we expect in most cases this will be reported as 0 or 100%. On slide 37, we return back to a familiar table to exhibit a few example reporting scenarios per chemical that a single company could come across when determining the need to submit manufacturing information as well as processing and use. So for chemical A, requires full reporting, including processing and use on the 2019 volume of 26,000, while B only requires reporting of the manufacturing because the 2019, the principal reporting year production volume is equal to 0. Chemical C doesn't meet the threshold for any year, so it doesn't require reporting, manufacturing or processing and use. And with chemical B, we're illustrating quite a few things. One, triggering the threshold based on an earlier year, like with chemical B due to the 2017 volume. Two, triggering with a lower threshold because of the Section 6 rule. And three, the need to report the full information on a year, the principal reporting year, even though that year, 2019's volume, is below the threshold. Moving on to slide 38, we'll talk about what this information actually entails. So as we've already indicated, processing and use-related data is required if meeting the threshold, the regular or the reduced, unless otherwise exempted. And a lot of green here, so we'll focus on some of the processing and use-related changes. Reporting the function category will not be required for commercial consumer products as well, commercial or consumer products as well, not just for the industrial processing use. And we're phasing in the replacement of the CDR industrial function and commercial consumer product use codes with codes based on the OECD function product and article use categories, or just the OECD-based codes is how I'll be referring to those. These will be familiar to for companies that are also reported internationally and are helpful to EPA for synthesizing data with other programs that also collect OECD information. So phasing in, what that means is during the upcoming 2020 CDR submission period, reporting using the OECD-based codes is only required for the chemicals designated by EPA as a high priority for risk evaluation. The full list of these 20 chemicals can be found at this URL and will be shown in a few slides. For all other chemicals, to allow reporters time to familiarize themselves with the OECD-based codes, they may use either these or the current CDR codes, the same as those used in 2016. Reporting using the OECD-based codes will be fully implemented and required for all chemicals during the 2024 submission period. In other words, these codes will be phased in completely at that point. Now on to slide 39 to see the rest of the required processing and use information. Looking at the first table on the industrial side of things, you'll report the type of processing and use operation, the sector, the functional use, and the associated percent production volume, number of workers, and number of sites. And looking at the bottom table on the commercial consumer side, you'll report the product category, whether the use is consumer, commercial, or both, the functional use, and whether used in products intended for use by children, and the associated percent production volume, max concentration, and the number of commercial workers. And to reiterate on each of the circled reporting elements, functional use for the commercial and consumer products in the bottom table is actually a new data element, and the other two are not new elements. They're just the ones impacted by the phase-in of the new OECD-based codes. Now, for a little context on what this information actually means to EPA, one combination of the first three elements in the top table, the industrial type, sector, and function, is considered a unique exposure scenario. The same goes for the combination of the first four consumer and commercial use elements in the bottom table, which together also amount to a unique exposure scenario. For example, these scenarios are critical in attaining the bigger picture of the chemical's conditions of use. Now on to slide 40. Here we just have a snapshot of the available function categories that you can use at the beginning of the table, basically. We can see that the new OECD-based codes are listed in column A and are associated or crosswalked with the current CDR codes in column B. The table of product categories isn't shown in this presentation, but those are displayed similarly with the column A and the connection to column B. These full crosswalk tables can be found in the rule as well as the 2020 instructions for reporting, which will be available in the rules docket and on the website, on the CDR website. On to slide 41 for another table that I mentioned earlier. Here's the list of the 20 high priority chemicals designated for risk evaluation. Again, if you're reporting any of these substances, you're required to use the OECD base code. And if reporting any other substances, you're allowed to, but not required to use the new codes. Moving on to slide 42, And here we just want to reemphasize a few things that reporting is site-specific, meaning there is one form U per site, which could have one or many chemical substance reports. So that's each chemical reported by the site. So again, for some perspective, there were about 8,700 chemicals reported in 2016, but around 42,500 chemical reports as a number of sites were manufacturing the same chemicals. We also want to stress that the reporting standard is known to or reasonably ascertainable by for all data. That term or phrase is defined at 40 CFR 704.3 and means all information in a person's possession or control, plus all information that a reasonable person similarly situated might be expected to possess, control, or know. Generally, this is information known by management or supervisory employees of the submitter. More in-depth examples of this type of information standard can be found in the instructions for reporting. On to slide 43, we'll go over some of the changes associated with making confidentiality claims. So the TSCA amendments in June 2016 required substantiation for most confidentiality claims. Now, upfront substantiation is required for all claims of confidentiality at the time they are made, except for production volume, which includes five separate data elements, one per year, 2016 through 2018, plus the domestically manufactured and the imported volumes for 2019. Also, supplier identity, trade name, and the formulation information associated with the joint submissions don't require substantiation. So the substantiation questions and certification statement have also been updated, and general use data elements that we went over previously can no longer be claimed as confidential. Specific elements are listed here for the processing and use, either the industrial or consumer and commercial. Moving on to slide 44 to talk about requirements for importers. So under TSCA, manufacturer includes import, and importers have much of the same requirements but have a few additional factors to consider. Site is defined for importers in 40 CFR 701.3 and is the U.S. site of the unit directly responsible for the importing. And that must be a U.S. Address, even if it is for an agent acting for the importer. An importer will indicate whether each imported chemical is never physically present at the reporting site. It's one of the elements I mentioned previously. If a mixture is imported, the importer reports the individual chemical components of the mixture, including the percent composition. A joint submission with the supplier is used when the chemical identity or mixture composition is unknown. And one of the new requirements for imported mixtures, the secondary submitter of a joint submission reports the function of the chemical within the mixture. Lastly, imported articles are exempt under 40 CFR 701.10B. Moving on to slide 45, so when identifying your imported substances and determining its requirements, so for sources of composition information, you can refer to the Material Safety Data Sheet or the MSDS. Or the SDS, the safety data sheet, or the supplier can provide composition information as well. If that information is claimed as confidential, you can ask the supplier to provide the information directly to EPA. And one of the new capabilities for joint submissions, both the primary and secondary submitters are able to identify parts of their submission as confidential. And similar to domestic manufacturer, use known or reasonably ascertainable information to determine whether your production volume triggers reporting. For imported mixtures, that would be the overall production volume for the whole mixture. And again, you can ask your supplier or refer to the MSDS or SDS for composition information. Moving on to slide 46, where we'll shift to information specific to byproducts. Now I'll just be giving us some background on byproducts and talking about some of the new byproduct specific exemptions. A byproduct is a substance produced with a separate commercial intent, or is a substance produced without a separate commercial intent during the manufacture, processing, use, or disposal of another chemical substance or mixture. These are typically manufactured for a commercial purpose and reportable when used for a non-exempt commercial purpose. On slide 47, we'll go over the first byproduct-specific exemption. The first new byproduct-specific exemption. EPA will now exempt specifically listed byproducts that are recycled or used in physically enclosed systems in a site-limited manner and when the site is reporting the byproduct or another substance from the same overall manufacturing process. By site-limited, meaning the byproduct remains on-site after manufacturing and if processed. The industries and byproducts that were listed and eligible for this exemption are cement kiln dust from Portland Cement Manufacturing and black liquor, oxidized black liquor, and calcium carbonate from the Kraft pulping cycle. Moving on to slide 48, as part of this exemption, a petition process was implemented to identify additional industries and byproducts that meet these criteria. These considerations for the petition process follow the criteria I mentioned in the previous slide, as well as whether or not EPA may have a current interest in the byproduct. Note that there's not time for petition for this the 2020 submission period, but petitions for consideration for the 2024 submission period will be due before December 31st, 2022. On slide 49, we'll move on to the second exemption. This exemption for byproducts that are generated in this is for byproducts that are generated in equipment that is not integral to the production process. The equipment we're referring to specifically is pollution control and boiler equipment. For context, an integral process is for the purposes of this exemption is the portion of the manufacturing process that is chemically necessary or provides primary operational support for the production of the intended product. And for a few examples of what equipment is likely to be integral or non-integral, reverberatory furnaces used for smelting and utilities using boilers to produce electricity as a product would be considered integral to the production process, whereas sites using boilers to produce heat or electricity for their facility but not as a product would not be considered integral. Examples of pollution control equipment that is likely to be non-integral includes flue gas desulfurization and selective catalytic reduction systems, both types of air pollution control, as well as, for instances, when a byproduct is produced while treating wastewater from cleaning tanks from a manufacturer's production process, a form of water treatment or pollution control. These are not listed here, but examples can also be found in the 2020 instructions when those are made available. On slide 50, we'll shift to talking about co-manufactured chemicals. The reporting mechanism for co-manufacturing has been updated in the past. This was referred to as toll manufacturing. For a little background, a co-manufacturing relationship occurs when a chemical substance manufactured other than by import is produced exclusively for another person who contracts for such production. Note that the co-manufactured reports are done as part of the overall form U. It doesn't require a separate report. So using the first new reporting methodology, the contracting company initiates the co-manufactured chemical report and notifies the producing company using the ECR web reporting tool. So that would have the looking at the table, both the contracting company and the producing company reporting their own production volumes, and the contracting company reporting the chemical identity and the processing and use information, and the producing company reporting all of the manufacturing information. On to slide 51, using the second new reporting methodology, the contracting and producing company, upon written agreement, work together to complete the reporting. In this scenario, the producing company initiates and completes the report, the reporting, providing exposure-related manufacturing information while the contracting company provides additional information. Although the producing company submits the report, both parties are responsible for the report. On slide 52, we'll shift our focus again to finish out this portion of the presentation. I'm going to walk us through a number of our non-regulatory updates. These are all intended to improve and streamline the reporting process. So we've completed the portion on the actual regulatory updates. There are a variety of IT and functionality enhancements that are being incorporated into the reporting tool. This includes a new application platform that lags less and has faster validation. There's streamlined CDI substantiations, auto-filling data from 2016 submissions, and improving the process of uploading data. In 2016, there were issues with uploading from an XML file, so now the reasons for the failures will actually be explained. We also will allow uploading data by CSV file now. An agent role has also been added to make the reporting process more versatile or flexible. We'll talk more about that on slide 54. Previously, there were just two roles, the authorized official who creates, signs, and submits the form, and support people who help to fill in the details of the form. If you're looking at the table, you can see that the support person only has the capacity to edit the form. So as requested, the agent role has been added, which is modeled after the new chemicals program and the PMN, or pre-manufacturing notice, submission process. Agents will have the ability or access to do the following in this middle column of the table, which includes editing, unlocking, and providing amendments to the original created form. Moving on to slide 55, for additional resources, we are in the process of updating all of the 2016 guidance documents, including the various fact sheets. On slide 56, we'll talk about where you can find this updated guidance. For the symbols resource, you can visit the CDR page where the updated information and guidance that I mentioned will be posted as it is developed. There you will be able to find the instructions for reporting and CDR's frequently asked questions, both of which have been updated to reflect the rules changes to reporting requirements, as well as you'll also be able to find any of the very informative industry-specific fact sheets. And lastly, reporting-related questions can be sent to ECDRweb at epa.gov. On slide 57, this list that we'll have a break for a Q&A session, but to make sure we get through both presentations fully, we'd like to postpone questions until we finish the reporting tool demo. And I'm just going to transition over to and hand it over to Carolina Falaye. Actually, I think Meredith may have something to mention before switching to the reporting tool demo.
Thank you, Tom. I'd just like to mention that we have completed going through the first section, the first document that is a slide deck, which you downloaded from the website. So we're now transitioning to the second slide deck, which is going to be a walkthrough of screenshots of the reporting tools. So just take a moment and close out the first PDF and transition to the second PDF. And I'll pass it over to Carolina.
Thank you, Meredith. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Carolina Falaye. I am with CGI Federal. And for the past 1.5 years, we have been working with EPA to understand the needs of the industry for a more flexible solution that allows them to accommodate all the different manufacturing scenarios. So I will go over the application with the screenshots. I am moving on to slide number 1 for a quick disclaimer that the screenshots included in this presentation are draft and they are may be subject to change. Moving on to slide number 2, we will go over the prerequisites to get access to the CDR 2020 applications, how to complete a Form U, which includes the form overview that captures information related to the parent company and site, the chemical information on the different scenarios that were considered during the redesign of the application. We will cover the process to report the chemicals manually or using a file to do bulk upload. We will also go over the process to provide the confidential business information, which I will refer to as CBI claims, and the reporting requirements and how to substantiate or provide answers to the required questions. And also go over the submission process and the existence of the secondary and tertiary forms. I am now moving on to slide number 3, which contains the Central Data Exchange homepage. As some of you may be familiar with other TASCA reporting applications, users are required to register in CDX to get access to all the TASCA applications. The user guide and the CDX provides an explanation of the user roles available for CDR and guidance on how to enroll in order to have the correct access to the CDR tool. This includes access and directions on how to sponsor a primary agent consultant or a secondary agent consultant. Slide number 2 displays the first page that the user will see where they need to select the role that they register as to get access to the application. Slide number 5 contains the chemical information submission system where the TASCA application displays. Something to mention is that all your prior data for 2012-2016 will be available in the 2012-2016 application, and the 2020 link will take you to the newly upgraded application only for CDR 2020 reporting. Moving on to slide number 6, this is what the user will see on their homepage, which allows them to see all the sites associated with the organization that they register with. The Create New button will allow them to start the form creating the passphrase, which I'll go over in a few slides. The pencil icon will allow them to edit an in-progress form. At the bottom, for the last site, I have an example of how to download the copy of record or the XML file once the submission has been received by EPA. And the lock button will allow you to unlock to make any edits after the form has been submitted. Slide number 7 displays a couple of things that we have included to help you navigate the application. This includes the resources, links, and frequent questions and quick reference guides to how to do things and navigate through the application. Also, access to the North American Industry Classification System to identify the next codes required for this site information. On the right-hand side, you will see the primary authorized official. In this case, because the user logged in as primary authorized official, so this gives you a brief description of the privileges the user will have, and it is basically different for each role. Slide number 8 will display and after the user has selected the Create New form. This provides the opportunity to secure your form. So this the user is required to provide a specific guidance on how to create the passphrase, and we are adding a new option to provide a hint to serve as a reminder of what the passphrase is. As any secure system, we recommend that you don't use the passphrase as your reminder, but that you use something that will trigger the memory to remember what you use as your passphrase. Slide number 8 will take us to the creation of the form. As Tom mentioned earlier, the requirement is to have one form per site. So we'll start with the form information, which includes the parent company information and the information displayed on this screen will come from the registration in CDX. So if you have registered under a U.S. company, this will display the domestic parent company. After you save in slide 11, you will see that your organization will display on that summary table. If you need to report a foreign parent company, you can select the Add Foreign Parent Company button, and all the fields required will display. If, on the contrary, you have registered as a foreign parent company, the requirement is to have a domestic parent company, so you must provide one before you can continue forward. The next slide number 12, displays the site information and the required fields. So we have the site Dun and Bradstreet number that needs to be provided, as well as the NAICS codes. Slide 13 will allow you to select from the NAICS code dropdown, which you can search by selecting the code or the description. And the activity classification, you can select from manufacturer, import, or both. And once those two fields are provided, you can add to list, and you will see it reflected as in slide 14. The requirement is to add at least one NAICS code, but you can add up to 3. The hyperlink under the header that says North American Industry Classification NAICS code, this hyperlink will direct you to the NAICS code website in case you can't find your code. Moving on to slide 15, this will guide us through the process and the different scenarios that we considered when reporting a chemical. The first page that you will see once you get to this chemicals tab is the chemical summary table. This table will host all the chemicals that you will report under that form or that site. There are two ways to report those chemicals. One, it's the add chemical, which is the manual process, and the second one is the bulk chemical upload, which we will discuss later in this presentation. Slide 17 contains the chemical identification page, which includes a couple of decision points that will direct you how or what you need to provide depending on the answers provided. So the question is, do you know the chemical identity of the substance you are reporting? If the answer is yes, you'll be taken to the SRS path. If you are an importer and you don't know the chemical identification, you will need to select the no, I'm an importer. And if you are a producing-only company, then you will select the no, I'm a producing company. For this first scenario, we'll select the yes, I know the chemical identity, and we'll select the click here to add chemical. Page 18 will display the SRS search, as Tom described, the functionality for finding your chemical on the service and the substance registry services. We have implemented communication with SRS, and so you will be able to search either by using the CASRN number or the accession number or the chemical name, with several different ways to search. Once you select the search button, slide 19 will show that the system is searching. Once the system has found this chemical on the SRS, if you search by accession or CASRN number, slide 20 will show you the results page, and this will contain only one record. But if you use the generic name or the chemical name, you may have multiple, and then you can use the filter functionality to search for the one that you wish to report. Once you identify the specific substance, you can select the radio button on the farther left and select the Save Chemical button to save the chemical. Moving on to slide 21, once you have saved the chemical, you will see the chemical name displaying the chemical that, name that came from SRS, the chemical identifier number, which is the number that you use to search the, in the service, in the registry. And in this case, because this is a substance that was in the confidential portion of the TASCA inventory, the user must select one of the two statements, whether he wishes to maintain an existing claim for the confidentiality of the chemical substance identity as listed in the confidential portion of the TASCA inventory, or if he does not wish to maintain it in the confidentiality. The three checkboxes at the bottom are to indicate whether you want to claim this information as confidential, the company information, site information, and technical contact information. If you are wanting to claim all these three items for all the chemicals that you reported, you might select them for each chemical. Otherwise, only the chemicals that have been selected will be considered this, will consider this information as confidential. Moving on to slide 22, as Tom mentioned, each chemical should provide a technical contact information. We have implemented a functionality where you can add all of your technical contacts with the first chemical that you report. And then by each chemical, you can select the technical contact that applies for each specific chemical. In this case, we'll create a new contact which you can add a new individual, or you can copy from your registration. Slide 23 contains the second part of the technical contact page. Once you save that information, moving on to slide 24, you will see the technical contact that you added listed on that table. You can create a new contact, or you can select this as the contact that applies for the chemical we're adding at the moment. If you select this contact, Jane E. Doe, then you can select it as default, and it will be the technical contact applied to all subsequent reported chemicals, or you can create an update as you go. Moving on to slide 25, we have reached our information for manufacturing, or our page for manufacturing information. In this page, the manufacturer and the manufacturing acting as contracting companies are required to provide the production volume for the prior years. And then we'll study or go over the following scenarios shortly. So slide 26, we're going to go over the report as a manufacturing company. As a manufacturing company, you'll select the first checkbox that reads, my site is reporting the production and use of the chemical. We have the manufacturing-related information, including the percentage of total production volume by weight that is manufactured as a byproduct, which is a new field. And then the report exposure-related information, and in slide 28, the bottom part of that page, is the report physical form for 2019 production volume. Slide 29 will take us through a similar, the same page, but the second scenario, which is the co-manufacturing company reporting as a contracting company. As a contracting company, you would select the second checkbox saying my company contracted a co-manufacturer to produce the chemical at their site. In that case, you will be required to provide the chemical alias, the calendar 2019 contracted production volume, and the volume that whether it was never physically at site, and the producing company information. Slide 31 will contain additional information for the producing company as well as generate the unique identifier the producing company will need to use during their reporting. You can add their email addresses and then send the email. Slide 33 will cover how the producing company will use that unique identifier that was provided by the contracting company. So the producing company will come into the application and select the chemical identification page as "No, I am a producing company," which will take them to the producing company and the manufacturing information page. And that will display the unique identifier data entry that once he selects the populate contracting company, will retrieve the information provided with that unique identifier for the primary company that contracted his services to produce the chemical. Aside from that, he should provide the chemical alias, the total production volume, and whether any of that percentage was produced as a byproduct. In slide 36, we see the bottom page of the manufacturing information, which includes the exposure-related information as well as the physical forms. Because they are producing only, they are not required to provide the use information. That information will be provided by the contracting company. Moving on to slide 37, we will cover the reporting as an importer. So in this case, in the chemical identification page, the importer will select the "No, I am an importer" option. They can claim the relationship with the important company as confidential by selecting the checkbox on the first checkbox. They also need to provide the trade product name or other designation that they use to facilitate the reporting with the secondary joint submitted. Once they have provided that, they need to provide the secondary company information and an email address so that the email can be sent with the unique identifier. Moving on to slide 39, we'll be able to see the rest of the email section where they can add the email address and send out the email on slide 40. Once they have sent out the email, that concludes for the imported the chemical identification page, and they can move on to provide the industrial processing and use information for that chemical. In this, we have the ad processor use for that particular chemical, and slide 42 displays all the fields that become an unique use by selecting the type of processing use, sector, and function category. The other change that happened during 2020 is now only the percentage production volume, number of sites, and number of workers can be claimed as CVI. The function category, as explained earlier, we have added the new codes, the OEDC codes that start with an F. So the user can select to find the codes by using the code or the description. This also includes the previous codes, the U codes. For the high priority chemicals, you will only see the list for the F codes. Once you select and add all the information, you can select the add to list and slide, and the use will be added to the table. Moving on to slide 44, we have a similar concept for the consumer and commercial use. When the user selects the add product category, slide 45 will display, and they can select the product category, the function category, the commercial, consumer and commercial, and whether the product was used for products intended for children. Similar concept where the CBI claims apply to the percentage production volume, maximum concentration, or number of commercial workers reasonably to be exposed. Slide 46 displays the updated codes. This will include the C codes as well as the CC codes. And the functionality works the same. You can find it by using the code or the description. That concludes the manual submission. Now on slide 47, we'll talk about how to upload a file or chemicals using a file. We will provide a template for an Excel file that will contain some drop-down values to help facilitate the submission. And the XML, if you have your XML from 2016, you may upload that file, or you may download it if you know the passphrase for your form. You may go to the 2016 application and use the green arrow to download the copy of record that you will find your XML. Once you have the file, you can select it from the location, as it's shown in slide 48. And slide 49, we will perform, or the system will perform, a couple of validations. Moving on to slide 50, the first validation that we will do is schema validation. So if you are uploading an XML file, we will validate it against the schema and provide the lines where your file may be failing because it doesn't meet the formatting requirement. And once that has been solved, you have to re-upload the file, and we will conduct the second validation, which includes checking against SRS to make sure that your CASRN or your accession number is listed there. If we don't find it in there, you will see the CASRN displayed on the bottom section that says the number of chemicals not found in SRS. So you can proceed with the troubleshooting process that will help you identify why the chemical wasn't found. Once all your chemicals have been added and the slide 16, the chemical summary page, has been updated with all the chemicals that you're ready to report, we'll move on to the CBI substantiation, as in slide 51. Slide 52 will take you to the review CBI claims page, which contains a brief explanation of what the icons mean, and on the left-hand side, we'll have the list of chemicals that you are reporting and their status. At this point, none of them have been substantiated, so that's why you don't see neither a green mark or a gray mark. Chemicals with gray mark will indicate that they have CBI claims, but none of the claims require substantiation, versus the green one will indicate that they have claims that require substantiation, but the substantiation has been provided. Moving on to slide 53, we'll have an example of a chemical who was claimed CBI or has CBI claims, and we have included the sections where the claims were made and the links that will take you to the applicable questions to substantiate. Each data element is required to provide answers for the general answers, which include 6 questions for each data element. And we will go over the specific chemical identity substantiation questions later on. Moving on to slide 54, after the user has provided all the questions, you'll see the status has changed to a check mark, a green check mark that allows you to know that that chemical is in good order. Slide 55 will allow you to edit the following chemicals. So using the information provided for the first chemical, you can reuse some of those answers as long as the same data elements are being claimed CBI. Slide 56 displays how you can select from a good standing chemical. You can select that chemical to retrieve answers that can be copied over. Slide 57, once you have selected that chemical, you will have a couple of options. You can copy only to the chemical that you're editing, or you can select to copy all to transfer the same answers across multiple chemicals for the same data element. Moving on to slide 58, you can see that only 2 were completed despite the fact that I used the copy all. This is because the accession number will require additional information for the chemical identity claim. slide 59 will display how those sections that have been completed will have a check mark indicating that that substantiation has been provided. In this case, the chemical identification substantiation questions have not been provided. Slide 60 will display the additional questions for the chemical identity. And therefore, once you complete it, slide 61 will display that all the chemicals have been properly substantiated, and you can continue with the submission of the form. Slide 62 will take us through the submission process. Once the user selects the continue button, they will find the submitting official information, which can also be claimed CBI. They are required to provide the position and to agree that they are the submitting legally responsible party for submitting the company. Once that checkbox on the bottom has been checked, the start submission process button is enabled, and we can move on to slide 65. The user is required to agree to a couple of certifications. The first one is the TASCA CBI certification, and once the user selects continue, slide 66 will allow him to certify to the CDR certification as well. Once that has taken place, we ran an additional validation to make sure that all the data elements required are provided and that nothing is missing. The review validation, if there are errors, we will see a validation window that will display the chemicals that are missing information and a link to return to that particular section to make any changes required. Slide 68 would allow you to download a draft of the submission. This is not an official submission. It is not to be submitted to EPA. It's just for your records. Once you have submitted, the final submission can be downloaded by the copy of record download functionality. Once you are ready to submit, then you can select the sign encrypt that submit button, and the slide 69 certification will display. Once you accept, slide 70 will display the authentication. This is the password from CDX, and then you provide the information from your 5-1 questions, and you electronically sign the form. After the sign, the signature has been completed, your form will be sent to EPA, processed, and once it is received and complete, you will see a case number assigned to your form. Slide 71 will display the secondary or joint form. For access to the secondary or tertiary form, the user would use the secondary authorized official or any of the secondary user roles. Secondary users see one form per year, and they as well have the resources and description of the role selected. Moving on to slide 74, they can enter all the chemical substances that make up the trade product name. Slide 75 will allow them to enter the unique identifier for the primary company that is reporting as importer. Once they select the populate primary company, they can see the information from that primary company on the table. They can enter more one or multiple companies. And this concludes the overview of the application tool. Meredith, that's all I have. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Carolina. So we're going to transition to slide 76. The title of this slide is Reporting Tool Beta Test. EPA is currently looking for up to 25 volunteers to test the ECDR web reporting tool. So that would involve going into the tool and testing it out before we open it up on June 1st. We ask that the volunteers should represent a range of the CDR submitters, so that means whether you manufacture or import, whether your company is large or small, whether or not you utilize a co-manufacturer when you report. So we're planning to do this in mid-April, and it will last for 1 week. If you are interested in volunteering, please send an email to ECDRweb. We have the email address right here, ecdrweb@epa.gov, no later than this Friday, April 3rd. And we hope that we can find some participants for our beta testing. Well, I think that we've run through all of our slides. So we're now, and we have plenty of time, so we're going to transition into a question and answer section.
At this time, if you would like to ask an audio question, press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you wish to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Once again, that is star, then the number one. Your first question comes from the line of Heidi.
Yes, when will the 2020 update to the SRS system be completed?
This is Susan Sharkey. The 2020 listings in SRS will be draft versions will be put in place in May, but because they represent the status of the chemical as of June 1st, they will not be final until June 1st. Okay, next question.
Caller, if you press star 1 and did not record your name, your line is open.
I want to find out what is the requirement for the beta test. Is that facility should be ready to submit at that time, or what is the scope of the beta test?
We expect you to use to just make up data. It's an opportunity to go in and test the systems to make sure that it's functioning as it should be functioning, and trying to find out if there's any problems or issues. The beta testers will be provided a test link to use, so you will not be using your own information to do so. You may choose to use your specific chemical data to conduct the testing, but it is not it will not be giving you a chance to start working on your submission.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Next question.
Yes, actually, my question has been asked and answered.
Thank you.
Your next question, caller, please, your line is open.
That has, say, the vehicle windshield washer fluid from a foreign plant, do you still have to report the number of workers exposed in the foreign plant when they filled up the vehicle with that windshield washer fluid, and whether there's any recycling activity in that foreign entity?
No, any of the information that you're providing on the CDR has to do with activities within the United States. So you
Thank
would
you.
Look at if you're in, yeah, okay.
Okay, thanks. And then the other question is, I did use the SRS to look up the ingredients of the vehicle windshield washer fluid, And the result was a very long list. It was difficult to explore how, whether that one ingredient was had the 2,500 or the 25,000 threshold. Does the CDX tool, if I have the cast number of that ingredient, does the CDX tool recognize that it's subject to the 2,500 or the 25,000 threshold? And if the answer is no.
Yes, it does.
Oh,
no,
the
answer is yes, it does, yes. It will give you a response back as to what the reporting requirements are for that particular cast number.
Paula, please go ahead with your question.
My question has to do with co-manufactured chemicals. Why would both the co-manufacturer, why would both companies report the calendar year 2019 production volume on the form? Shouldn't that value be the same for both of them?
One would hope that it would be the same, but there's a potential that the information each one has is different because other information that's reported on each of the forms is based on the percent production volume. We just wanted to make sure that we knew exactly what production volume, that percent production volume was referring to.
But since they're talking to each other and have to communicate with each other, wouldn't they confirm that they're both reporting the same production volume for calendar year 2019?
One would hope so.
Okay.
There are a variety of different manufacturing scenarios that are possible, and so a contracting company may be using multiple producing companies, and in
right.
that case, their production volume would be larger than the producing company's production volume.
Yeah, that would be
and
confusing.
They might not want
if
to share
they're making
that
the same chemical for a bunch of different companies, then the quantity of the chemical that's associated with each company would add up to it a larger volume. I could see that.
Right, right. Actually, it would be the other way around because the producing company should only be making it for one contracting company.
Right. Okay.
Paula, go ahead with your question. Paula, please go ahead with your question. Caller, please go ahead with your question.
That.
I'm sorry, sir, your question again?
Does the authorizing official have to be the one to go in to create the new form and to create the passphrase, or can the agent that's doing most of the input take care of that?
No, the authorized official is required to initiate the report and create the passphrase. After that's done, the authorized agent can do pretty much everything else and can even go in and make amendments if needed at a later date.
And then I can assign the supporting personnel that can do the data entry as well? As the agent?
Oh.
Or does the certifying official have to authorize everybody that's going to be working on the project?
I am not sure.
Sorry, Susan. This is Carolina. Yes, the primary agent consultant will be able to assign supports if needed.
Thank you.
Howell, please go ahead with your question. Howell, please go ahead with your question.
Hello, I assume that I'm open. When will the instructions be ready for the 2020 reporting? I heard them alluded to.
The instructions are currently waiting for publication of the final rule. Once it's actually finalized or published, it's been signed. The pre-publication version is available on the EPA website, but it has not been yet published by the Federal Register. Once that happens, the instructions will be submitted to OMB for review as guidance materials, and we will be placing them in the docket associated with the final rule. We are hoping to be able to also provide a link to that directly from our website, but I am still waiting for confirmation from OMB that we are able to do that. So the short answer to your question is you will have access to the 2020 instructions through the final rule docket at the time that the Federal Register publishes the final rule.
Caller, please go ahead with your question.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, this is Christina Franz from ACC. So first of all, thank you so much for hosting the webinar. It's really very helpful. I would note that it's very difficult to figure out which caller the operator is referring to when she says that please proceed with your question. So if there's some way to identify who she's calling upon, that would be really helpful. I have a question about the CBI substantiation. It was unclear to me during the presentation, and forgive me if I misunderstood, but it was unclear to me that when substantiating a CBI claim that has been claimed and substantiated previously in some other, TSCA activity, whether in the CDR you can reference that prior substantiation. It seems that there should be some coordination. You're undertaking an entire process for folks to be claiming chemical identity in the active inventory, and it seems like there's a lot of potential for duplicative substantiation and activity, which would be not only imposing a huge burden on companies, but also on EPA to have to be doing multiple rounds of review of claims.
At this point, there is not a way to connect substantiations that were previously provided. I recognize the issue that you're identifying, but there is also not there is no requirement that the entity that is submitting the CDR reporting form is the same entity that submitted the CBI substantiation when it was listed on the inventory. So there's a lot of different issues associated with that. But the bottom line is that right now there's not a way to connect those substantiations.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, that is star then number one for any audio questions. Your next question is from Linda Rogers.
Yeah, I'm still confused about co-manufactured chemicals. If we manufacture a chemical and sell that chemical under our trade name, and we also place that chemical in the company-specific bag of a customer of ours and ship that chemical directly from our facility to their end user, are they considered a co-manufacturer?
Not likely.
Okay.
A co-manufacturer is when you have not only it's more than just a contract between the contracting company and the producing company, but it's also where the contracting company is specifying a lot of things about that particular chemical, including how it's manufactured, what the technology is to manufacture it, and it's a one-to-one relationship. So it is not meant to cover the situation where you have a contract with a company to supply a chemical that you are also making for other reasons.
Okay, thank you.
Next question.
Thank you.
Hello, Christy, are you there?
Roxanne Casey, your line is open.
Hi, I just have a question in regards to manufacturer versus importing. We blend or process chemistry, but we also import finished goods from our sister locations around the globe. So it's unclear to me whether or not we need to report as a manufacturer or an importer.
If you are domestically procuring the ingredients for your mixtures, then you are not manufacturing. If you're just mixing them and there's no reaction occurring where you're not making a new substance, then you're not triggering the need to report. For the items that you're importing, you need to consider whether you are importing an article, or if you're importing when you say finished product, if you mean a mixture, then you do need to consider the components of the mixture you're importing and whether each of those individual components need to be reported. There are two fact sheets on our website, and for the basics, you can use the 2016 fact sheets. One has to do with importing and one has to do with imported articles. How to tell if you have something that is an article or is not an article.
It's chemistry. It's a mixture. But when we were going through the slides for the actual CDX reporting, it confused me as to whether or not I should be reporting as an importer or a manufacturer, because we are importing the finished chemistry as a mixture.
Right. So the definition of manufacturer includes importer.
Okay.
And so you report as a manufacturer, and you report that you're importing the chemical.
I just wanted to be clear. Thank you very much for answering my question.
Certainly.
Your next question comes from the line of Beth Carruthers.
Hello. I actually have a twofold question regarding the agent consultant role. First off, I wanted to check, will the onboarding sponsorship of a new agent consultant follow the same process as is followed for other CSPP areas such as TSCA Section 5?
Hi, this is Carolina. Yes, it will follow the same process.
Okay, and just as a follow-up, if someone has already been sponsored as an agent consultant for again, same example, Section 5, will they already have access to the 2020 CDR tool as well, or will a separate sponsorship be required?
They should have access to CDR.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Mike Oshansi.
I am an importer of mixtures, right? And if I have a mixture that I'm bringing in at a rate under 25,000 pounds per year, but one of the components in that mixture is present in another mixture where I'm bringing in over 25,000 pounds per year, do I report both components?
Yes, you need to consider each individual chemical in the mixture and then look across everything that you're importing or manufacturing and combine the production volumes to determine for that particular substance, do you need to report it? So you might have the situation you described. It sounds like one of the components of the lower volume substance, the volume of that component would be added to the same chemical from the other substance, the other mixture that you're importing.
Okay, but since they're used sometimes in very different applications, how do you fill out the rest of the data? for that one substance.
Right. So you have, you know, say you have 100,000 pounds of the one substance, and 90% of it goes to use A and 10% of it goes to use B, then you would just say that.
Okay.
Your next question comes on the line of Joe Zabel.
Hi. My question is regarding processing and use information when reporting for a substance that is not subject to certain regulatory actions under TSCA. So slide 37 is my reference, and you have an example for chemical D where there is a volume for the primary reporting year of 2019, and it indicates to report processing and use on that 1200. And my question is simply for substances that are at the 25,000 pound threshold, if you had a similar scenario, let's say chemical B, that had met the threshold for one of the previous reporting years, 2017, but only had, let's say, 1,000 kilograms for 2019, would you also need to report the processing and use on that 1,000 kilograms for 2019?
Yes. Yes. Basically, you trigger the need to report based on any of those 4 years, but you only report the processing and use information based on the 2019 volume. So if it's zero, there won't be anything to report. If it's 1,000, then you would be reporting on a small volume, even though that volume is under the level that would trigger the need to report.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Your next question is on the line of Heidi.
Yes, my question is for the data validation process in the CDF. Program.
Heidi, I'm having trouble hearing you.
Okay, So my question is about data validation. Is that something that the authorized official has to do, or could that be done ahead of time by some of the other to say time again?
I'm sorry, I still wasn't able to hear your question. It had to do with the authorized official, but I wasn't sure what the rest of the question was.
Yes, let me try again. So under data validation, is that something that you should do, or is that something that you have to
do? I still wasn't able to hear you. Can anybody else understand what she's asking? Your voice is very, very far away.
Yeah, Heidi, it sounds like you start up close. We can hear you at the beginning, but if you can just try again.
Is this better?
Oh, much better.
Okay, sorry about that. Let me repeat my question again. So the question is about data validation.
As an agriculture company rooted in our connection to food, farming, and the land, we are always looking for new ways to carry forward the Simplot legacy of bringing Earth's resources to life.
Hello? Did you hear my question?
No, because some recording came on during it.
Oh, dear. Okay. Well, let me try one more time. I'm sorry. So for the data validation step in CDX, is that something that could be done ahead of time by the agent or someone else preparing the report, just to avoid any issues that might be coming up with the data? Or I just wanted to see if that would be possible to do ahead of time before it actually gets to the authorized official.
Yes, this is Carolina. Yes, the validation can be done at any point. We have a button at the bottom. I can look for this slide for reference. If you look on slide 42 at the bottom, we have the save, validate, and preview buttons. The validate button will grant those validations at any point during the submission. So, yes, it can be validated way before it goes to the primary authorized official for submission.
Thank you so much, and I apologize for the technical issues I was having.
Your next question comes from the line of Peter Miranda.
Hi, thank you. I had a question, and let me give the example here. If I'm an importer of a chemical formulation, and one of those chemicals that's in that formulation is an impurity, but that chemical is one of the 20 prioritized TSCA chemicals now planned for future review, should I be concerned if that chemical impurity is meets the 2,500-pound threshold?
Can you... I knew the answer to it until you mentioned that it was one of the priority chemicals. Can you please email that question to ecvrweb@epa.gov?
I sure can.
Thank you very much.
Your next question will be from the line of David Corori. Your next question comes from
agriculture
line of Kat
company
Gale.
Rooted in our connection to food, farming, and the land, we are always looking for new ways to carry forward the.
Carrie Wells, your line is open.
Is the expectation that if the small manufacturer definition is not finalized prior to June 1st, that it would not apply to the CDR? Are you expecting it's going to be finalized prior to the CDR?
Answering the second question first, we do anticipate that it will be finalized prior to the beginning of the CDR. However, if it is not, it will, when it is finalized, it will go into effect. So if you are a, if you think that you might qualify as a small business under the new definition, you might want to wait to submit your report until later in the submission period.
Your next question will come from Rain Anderson.
Yes, hi, thank you. If we acquired a manufacturing site, let's say in 2017 or 2018, can we use the 2016 data that was reported? Will we be able to use their data from 2016?
You can if they provide you the information to access the that data. They have the ability to, you know, they have the passcode and can provide that to you. It also might vary depending upon what type of acquisition that was. If it
okay.
was a, yeah, okay.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is Meredith. I know that we're getting to the 3 o'clock cutoff, My suggestion would be that we take one more question, and then for people who are still interested in, who still have questions, we're going to ask that you send them to ECDR Web.
Your next question will come from Robert Rowe.
Yes, hi there. I got, maybe I'll try to squeeze in two questions in here. One is, first question would be, what if a facility closed down in 2019? Does that company, I guess, still need to file an EDR for the four-year period if they did exceed any of the thresholds? And number two, real quick, is, can you give a little better explanation on the importation that's supposed to be, what it's supposed to be done in that in 2016, we basically indicate that we were importing a material, and we indicate the volume of that. I think that's roughly was about it. Now it looks like we have to send an email, I guess, or email goes to whoever the supplier is of that chemical, and then they have to also do a go in through CDR or CDX and do a CDR report also. I guess I'm trying to get that figured out a little bit clearer.
Yeah, I'll start with your import question.
Okay.
The only time you need to do a joint submission with the importer is if you do not know the identity of the chemical substance.
Okay.
That happens sometimes when you're importing a mixture and it's a proprietary composition.
Okay.
And so that's the only time. Otherwise, you can just report it if you know the chemical identity.
Okay.
Your first question, right, had to do with a company that closed down in 2019. Is that what you said?
They stopped operation, yes, in 2019. So all complete operation. So, I mean, theoretically, I guess the company doesn't exist anymore, per se, or the facility doesn't exist at least anymore. So I'm assuming someone still needs to put a report in for them.
I am not sure the answer to that question. If you could send it to us through ECDR web at epa.gov, that'd be great.
Okay. Thank you. I will do that.
All right, we have reached 3:00, which unfortunately is the cutoff time for our webinar today. We apologize that we don't have enough time to answer all of the questions in real time, but we, of course, want to hear from you and respond to any additional questions that you may have. So if you have any more questions, please email them to ecdrweb@epa.gov. Again, that's ecdrweb@epa.gov. It's also listed in the slides that you referenced today. So if you send a question to that email address, we will do our best to answer it in a timely manner. But again, I would just like to iterate, we appreciate you participating today. I know a lot of people are working remotely and technical issues are a bit more complicated. So we really appreciate the engagement from the reporting community. And that's all I have to say, unless anyone else who a leader on the phone wants to add anything to that. All right, well, thank you. I'm signing off here.
Ladies and gentlemen, you may disconnect at this time. Presenters, please hold.